Rethinking the Vietnam War was the topic of a recent adult education course here at the Smithsonian, where military historians and scholars explored the war in all its complexity, regional history and battlefield action, diplomacy and folklore. In our next story, Radio Smithsonian's Baird Strawn takes a closer look at a seldom heard side of the Vietnam story, its music.
20 years ago, the United States was engaged in the longest war in its history. 463,000 combat troops were in Vietnam. Each day, around 20 died. 100 were wounded. Public debate about the war spilled over into popular songs.
And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam.
There were many songs about Vietnam which the American public never heard. Songs by the troops themselves, for the troops themselves.
I'm just a dog-faced soldier. I am not elite. I don't wear no green beret, no jump boots on my feet. I'm just a dog-faced soldier, doing the best that I can. I'm just a dog-faced soldier, plain old American.
Most of these songs came from the early part of the war, before 1968, when the war still seemed like a good cause likely to have a good end. They were usually sung by amateurs, recorded on amateur equipment as mementos. The largest collection of them was made by General Edward Lansdale, Chief of Psychological Operations in Southeast Asia, who taped singers at informal occasions in Saigon from 1962 to 1966. Lansdale thought of the recordings as snapshots. 60 of them he put together and sent to the White House to give U.S. leaders a little of the flavor of the war.
I don't want to join the army. I don't want to go to war.
In all, Lansdale collected some 200 songs, serious and satiric, sung with guitar accompaniment or alone or in chorus. This song, I Don't Want to Join the Army, I Don't Want to Go to War, was recorded in the field, in a tent, and mailed to Lansdale by the Merrymen, a group from the Army's 173rd Assault Helicopter Company. Les Cleveland, a research fellow at the Smithsonian's Wilson Center, says it has a long history, all the way back to the Battle of Waterloo.
The military happens to be an almost perfect site for the transmission of certain types of folklore. You've got a kind of a frontier subculture going in the military situation, especially in wartime. And that's when people rely on their memories of who they are and what they can sing and what they can do to amuse themselves. And that's exactly the climate in which folk song flourishes.
We flew in the Wolfpack with Robin Hood, some of us ain't coming back. In a Foxtrot 4 called a Phantom 2, we flew with the Red River Rats.
There's a lot of jargon in military folk songs. The songs of fighter pilots and helicopter pilots and people like that express a certain kind of narrative excitement at the business of being involved with that technology and pursuing particular missions and targets.
A good example of the Vietnam fighter pilot songs was the Ballad of Robin Olds by Dick Jonas, who was stationed with the 8th Tactical Fighter Wing in Thailand. Jonas recorded his songs after he came back to the U.S. and sent a copy of his tape to Lansdale.
Bandits, bandits over Thud Ridge, Mid-Ridge and Highfall too. No sweat, sir, Robin Olds is there, and behind him is the Wolfpack crew.
In Saigon, at Lansdale's parties, where bureaucrats and top brass mixed freely, many singers simply revised the lyrics of well-known tunes. A master of this was Dolph Droege, an official with the Agency for International Development.
Infiltration, that infiltration. You don't see nothing, you don't hear nothing.
Droege wanted his songs to entertain and get a message across to his listeners.
You were trying to get a memo across to someone of much higher rank than you, in a party situation, an entertainment situation. The guard is down, you see. It's a convivial, friendly atmosphere.
Oh, me name is McNamara. I've got a special band. And every couple of weeks or so, I fly to old Vietnam. I assemble the troops, count communists.
One of Droege's favorite targets was overly optimistic reporting on the war.
And hardly a governed flag survives after the close of day. But have no fear, victory's near, that is plain to see. I don't believe the New York Times, just rely on me.
As the war went on, the music changed. Chuck Rosenberg is an Army veteran studying the songs of Vietnam for the New York State Vietnam Veterans Memorial Project.
You take the earliest period, the advisory period, you have older professional soldiers. Those that had musical tastes were somewhat more well-defined in their tastes. They were more educated. You have the Kingston Trio type parodies. You have parodies of mainstream pop, Tony Bennett type songs. I'm talking about 1962, 63. The troop build-up period, you see a combination of homemade folk materials that are folk revival influenced, and they're, you know, amateur and semi-professional performers who have become GIs.
First team, first cab, black and yellow patch. It's the greatest fighting team there is. No other one can match.
Bill Ellis sang with the San Francisco band until he was drafted in 1968. Sent into combat with the 1st Cavalry Division, Ellis composed songs in his spare time and was soon pulled out of the fighting to cut a record, which the 1st Cavalry presented to all its men. Ellis then went on morale tour. The Army needed entertainers. The new troops were young, they were nervous, and the fighting was getting heavier. Ellis went to the most exposed fire bases where non-military entertainers couldn't go.
You never know when it's gonna happen. All you hear is an AK snapping. You hit the dirt and start a praying and hope that someone hears what you're saying.
I would catch a helicopter whenever and wherever I could and just fly out to fire bases and sing to the guys on the bunkers. And it was quite an emotional experience because a lot of times the guys would maybe have just come in within a couple of hours of maybe a firefight in the field. The guys would sometimes break up, we all would. At first, when I started doing this, I felt maybe this wasn't the right thing to do. But as it went along, it seemed to be the right thing because it was a release. It was something that we all shared.
Firefight. Firefight. Just had another firefight. Lead was flying. Men were dying. War is hell and full of fright. Just had another firefight.
I've still got some pictures of some of my jaunts out to the fire bases.
You never know.
What I see is, you know, and what I saw was and felt was just a great distance of thinking about home. I mean, that was the main thing on everybody's mind. And a real brotherhood, a real, real closeness that that I haven't felt since Vietnam.
Well, here I am, waiting for the bird that will take me home.
American combat troops were now primarily draftees, not volunteers, 18 and 19-year-olds instead of the experienced soldiers who'd come to fight before. They held on to their radios, but few wrote music. Chuck Rosenberg, producer for the New York State Vietnam Veterans Memorial Project.
As the buildup expanded, and then the war started to wind down, I think you saw more consumer-type usage of rock music. The tastes of the GIs were somewhat different than the tastes of the back home in the world top 40 fans. They expressed some of their feelings by adopting very morbid and cynical album cuts. They had favorites. There were things by The Animal, Fade to Black, or there was some of the Jimi Hendrix material and so forth.
See your red door and
colors in my life. You better turn them black.
I have a good friend who's a Ford Observer in the Third Marines. A favorite song in his unit was The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down. You know, a song about half of our country losing its own Civil War.
There were many other songs from Vietnam, but for the time being, they lay dormant in the memories and nightmares of the young GIs who came home and usually wanted nothing more than to forget. The public in the recording industry wanted to forget, too. Only recently has the music emerged, as some veterans come to terms with their experience in song. Lydia Fish is a folklorist from Buffalo State College in New York who collects the songs from Vietnam and from veterans. She explained why the veterans had developed their own special music.
Because the vets came back and felt so alienated, because often the people who protested the war were their own age group, they often came back and felt very cut off. Many vets have formed their own subculture. It is in a subculture that folk song can flourish. It's not part of mainstream America, it's part of vet culture.
Rick Duvall was one alienated veteran, a songwriter who came back to the United States in 1969. Carrying with him memories from 64 ambushes and the recollection of one 13-year-old Viet Cong girl, his first kill.
For the first year, I just wanted to forget about the war, and so that's what I did. And then it started to creep back in, and as it crept back in, I realized that the American public was not even interested in the slightest bit of hearing a veteran who'd been to Vietnam and killed those 13-year-old girls. They don't want to hear what I have to say. I am simply to blame. I was so angry after about 2 years of that I quit admitting that I was a Vietnam vet.
At first, Duvall wrote songs only about romantic love. Then he made a breakthrough.
In 1975, I wrote a song called Sergeant Willie that was inspirational for me because it showed me that I could write about this stuff and I could sing it to people in a way that they would hear the message.
Willie came back home before he ever could be through with war. Something in his eyes had gone away. His family and his friends agreed. Nam had claimed his sanity, and he's in combat to this very day. The government had trained him well to fight, then die and go to hell.
The melody line and the soothing guitar took the message actually into the listener's heart, and they heard it, and it made a giant difference in the way I felt about saying it. So it brought me out of this antisocial place into a place where I couldn't wait to sing it for somebody again.
Sergeant Willie.
For Duvall, as for many others, songs are a way to explain the war experience to those who never knew it. Songs also helped hold veterans groups together during the hard years when they struggled for political recognition. Lydia Fish.
Folk song becomes part of bonding, defining groups, saying things are tough for us, but we're here together.
A walking man, doing what he can, walking to remember the forgotten man.
Songs figure in almost all large veterans events, like the Journey to Remember, a march from Texas to Washington, D.C., led by two songwriters, Michael J. Martin and Tim Holliday. Songs are also a way to reach beyond combat veterans to the much larger audience, which was indirectly involved in the war.
As far as I'm concerned, everybody that was on the planet is a veteran of that experience. And just some of us had the uniforms and some of us had the bullets.
Joe Paquin is a veteran who began to write songs after he came home in 1969. He performs in the San Francisco Bay Area, sometimes with a troupe called Vietnam Never Again. And he believes that the many new songs from Vietnam veterans are helping to close the wounds of the war.
It's something that heals me as I do it, and also I think it helps a lot of other people that are unable to articulate their feelings concerning the experience.
And at the tender age of 20, I lost my tenderness, hardened by the duty I had done. I might have shot up half of Vietnam to avenge my brother's death, 'cause I was just a kid
with all the guns. I was just a kid with all the ammo, and I was just a kid who had it all.
Today there's renewed interest in the songs of the Vietnam War. Some, like those of Dick Jonas and Rick Duvall, are now available commercially. The Lansdale tapes are the basis of a television documentary being produced by veteran Steve Brown. There were many, many other songwriters in Vietnam, black songwriters, choirs, soldiers who sang against American bombing raids. In their political views, they differ as much as ever. What they share is music, which, in every case, helped to bring them through the war intact.
I was just a kid in 1968. You were just a kid. Hell, we all were just kids and nothing more.
For Radio Smithsonian, this is Baird Strawn.
From Saigon, this is American Forces Vietnam Network.
By the men who are fighting for our nation and for what we believe in.
And we bring the truth to the first-termers in the Republic of Vietnam. We also bring you hard acid rock music all through the night.
Hello, I'm Scott Simon, and this is Vietnam, Radio First Termer, a two-part program from National Public Radio, produced by Interlock Media in Boston. For the next half hour, we'll explore radio in Vietnam during the war, what was and wasn't heard.
Good morning, Vietnam.
The broadcast would start off every morning with this fellow that I'm sure everybody wanted to shoot. He would yell, "Good morning, Vietnam!" And you wanted to plug him up right there.
In the field, we had things that were very important to us, obviously weapons and ammunition, but also maps, compasses, and right up there on that list, you had your little 495 Sony with the earpiece that infected your ear all the time, because you'd stick it in your ear and when you went to bed at night to kind of block out where you might have been.
Gary Farrington served with the 1st Cavalry Division.
We're listening to the game at 4:30 in the morning out on the Cambodian border in these little tiny two-man mosquito net hooches that we put up late at night to keep the critters off us. And we're supposed to be observing light and noise discipline, and you're always worried about getting an attack in the middle of the night, particularly in the area we were in. But all through the night, you could hear these little clusters of people around their little tiny $5 radios going, "Yeah, all right," yelling and cheering, and that's the way we listened to the Super Bowl in 1969.
From about a month ago, that's Charlie Rich, and I want to be a part of your life. At 20 minutes now after 5 o'clock, country music coming your way from the Da Nang studios of the American Forces Vietnam Network. I'm Army Specialist Billy Williams, where the country music hits all the way until 6 o'clock tonight. Here's Johnny Darrell. Why you been gone so long?
Every time it rains, Lord, I run to my window.
Special Forces vet Tom Wallace served in Vietnam for over a decade.
You just wanted to be able to put on a headset and hear an old song that you remembered from the 60s or something being played, or something about the news, whether it was a week old or this or that or the other, just to hear another voice or whatever, rather than the same sounds of incomings or outgoing rounds or talking to the same people all the time. It was just a different voice that you got to hear.
Informative. Swinging. The American Forces Vietnam Network. Four little words, but they signify over 6 years of broadcasting service to American servicemen in Vietnam.
My radio was just like my rifle. My radio was wrapped up in black tape, wrapped up in a Prick 25 battery bag, taped down to keep the moisture out.
Sitting on a darker bay, wasting time.
In the mid-60s, at the onset of U.S. involvement, American Forces Radio was a loosely run setup operating out of Saigon's Rex Hotel. As the war escalated and AFVN expanded, the military establishment would face setbacks on the battlefield, apathy among the troops, and a growing anti-war movement back home. What should or should not be broadcast over AFVN became a critical issue.
That was the only communication link you had with reality.
Jerry Irby.
You understand what I'm saying? They could censor. They can censor the news, but they can't censor music and its lyrics, so music was important to me.
Michael McCusker, who served as an Army information officer, takes a dim view of Armed Forces Radio.
They would have the soldier of the month sort of attitude towards it, you know, and without the news, we hardly acknowledge that there was a war going on. It's just another base, you know, that they're producing this program for. This one just happens to be a place where you're getting shot at. You got the same radio personnel, they're saying the same crap, playing the same music.
Tom Struther served in the Air Force in 1969.
Armed Forces Radio was an extension of the Army. It was very much an instrument of policy, but it was operated by Spec-4s who smoked marijuana, and you knew damn well that they were Spec-4s and Spec-5s that smoked marijuana and didn't like the war and didn't like their officers and didn't like being in Vietnam. And if they could have said that, they would have said that. And they came as close to saying that as they conceivably could without stepping over the boundary.
In 1967, while the war escalated in Vietnam, at home it was the summer of love. Pop music began to reflect a growing drug culture and social protest. Programming for Armed Forces Radio worldwide originated in Los Angeles, but not even all of their top songs made it to the playlist in Vietnam. AFVN DJ Scott Manning.
The great obvious censorship tune that they didn't send was Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town by Kenny Rogers in the first edition, because it had this line in there about having my leg shot off in the crazy Asian war. And so I don't think we ever did get Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town. But they didn't send Cloud Nine by The Temptations because they were sure that that was a drug song.
Hi, love.
For some, the most important thing was just hearing a voice from home.
Welcome, everybody, to another date with Chris. This is Chris Noel, and I'm going to be with you for the next 55 minutes with all kinds of real good sounds. First, we have a group called The Grassroots, I Wait a Million Years.
Chris was the love of your life when you heard her, but I never got a chance to see Chris Noel in person. She was the gal back home, the gal that wasn't back home, but seen back home on the radio. It was just nice to hear her.
Mark Stacy and Gary Farrington.
Everybody felt in one way or another that she was there specifically for him, and that she was doing whatever she could do to make his little bit in the war a little more palatable.
Yeah, because you were really, that was really your tie.
And, well, you'd defend her like she was your sister.
That's right.
The person who wrote this letter signed off like this. I am not going to sign this as I am not important. What is important are the men who are fighting for our nation and for what we believe in. The need was so intense. There were so few women that were in Vietnam. And in many cases, young men had left at the age of 18. And maybe some of them didn't even have a girlfriend before they left. And all these men were going through so much with so little female energy.
My intent by being on the radio was to be positive and just put across the feeling, you can make it, you can make it, you can make it, you can come home.
Other DJs, like Scott Manning, had their own ideas on building morale. They reveled in their on-air antics, seeing just how much they could get away with.
Park Lanes were a brand of French cigarette, which were heavily advertised around Vietnam. There were billboards all over for them and things like that. But the Park Lanes that the GIs got on the streets of Saigon and probably through the rest of the country, somewhere in a little room somewhere in the Chinese section, they'd carefully emptied all the tobacco out of each one and they had stuffed them full of marijuana. It was very good marijuana, too. So we were doing some mock Saigon traffic reports. And actually, I think the name we started using was Parker Lane or something like that, flying high over Saigon.
That's right, Scotty. This is flying specialist Parker Lane and my co-producer and pilot, Willie Crabrock, on control. During the past hour, we flew down here to Da Nang from Quang Tri. I have never in all my life seen such beautiful stretches of turnpikes and freeways as we have here in Da Nang. Strange that nobody's using these wide concrete roads.
Just to say something first about anti-war sentiment there. We were not very politically motivated in that way, and we weren't trying to get out anti-war messages because we were there.
From Saigon, ladies and gentlemen, the beat goes on.
News reports that might cause alarm or embarrassment were harder to slip past the scrutiny of programming officers. Announcer Adrian Kronauer witnessed the bombing of a popular Saigon restaurant.
I went back to the station and tried to put this item on the air, tried to get it cleared to put on the air, and the duty officer at MACV merely said, no, we can't put this on the air. I had seen with my own eyes bodies severed in two, heads decapitated. And barring the second coming, there was no way they were going to get up and walk away. And his answer was, well, we just don't know for sure. Therefore, you cannot put it on yet.
This month, you will have an opportunity to learn a great deal about our South Vietnamese allies. February 17th is the first day of the Lunar New Year, or more simply, Tet. Tet is like Christmas, New Year's, Easter, and the 4th of July combined. For the Vietnamese, it is a time of solemnity, gaiety, and hope. It is also a time to look at the past, enjoy the present, and look forward to the future. Show courtesy and consideration toward the Vietnamese people during Tet, and respect the fragment of peace it brings to Vietnam.
The devastating North Vietnamese offensive on the eve of the Tet holiday in 1968 marked the turning point in the war. The conflict moved from remote provinces to the heart of Saigon.
I felt when I arrived in Vietnam in 1969 in the wake of the Tet Offensive that there was a very deliberate glossing over of the bad news on Armed Forces Radio.
CIA agent Frank Snepp didn't need AFVN to tell him what was going on. Still,
the omission was glaring. Tucking the news in 5 minutes of a feed from the United States, when you're sitting across from a firefight on the other side of the Saigon River, I mean, that's the reality, or the mismatch of realities that I'm talking about. It's the rationing of the news rather than the censoring of the news that was most significant. If you were operating in intelligence and listening to Armed Forces Radio, because a kind of cynicism sets in. And once you get cynical and in the intelligence business, you can begin rationalizing lots of things, lots of excesses. And Armed Forces Radio was a factor in making a lot of us a lot harder and maybe even nastier than we needed to be. Because it was a factor in shaping our perception of reality and the cause we were serving. And you knew the pap that was being peddled on Armed Forces Radio, your reaction was to sort of shrug and say, well, why should I report the truth when the truth has no audience?
UPI field correspondent Bill Riley interviewed troops in the field. They often complained they were not being given the complete truth.
There's always a lot of rumors, though, around the fighting outfit, isn't there?
I hear a new rumor every day, just about. One bad thing about this place is that, well, you don't know, you're not informed enough. I haven't heard too much news from the battle, but just what that we won, you know, and they gave us a body count. Personally, I didn't see that many VC up there or NVA up there. That they said they counted 714 NVA killed on that battle, but they must have dug them up or something, or figured it out some way. I'm not sure myself whether we won that battle or not.
Thank you very much, Private First Class Harold Head of High Point, North Carolina.
If you go into a scrap and just get really chewed up and lose almost everybody, and you manage to crawl out of there and have your nervous breakdowns and lick your wounds and hope you got a few days of doping off before they come at you again or send you out in the paddies again.
Former Army Information Officer Michael McCusker, he listened to reports over AFEN of firefights he'd just been in.
In the latest round of rocket and mortar attacks, the U.S. command says about 25 Allied bases and South Vietnamese towns were shelled, but overall damage and casualties were light.
Begin to realize they're talking about us, you know, that bloody slaughter we just managed to crawl through. Now is suddenly we won again, you know.
Spokesman said an estimated 2 enemy battalions attacked a 25th Infantry Division outpost and lost 198 men. U.S. casualties were 13 dead and 3 wounded.
I don't think hardly at any time were any casualties as heavy unless it fit a political purpose. But most of the time it was light or moderate, so that nobody back home would sweat it and think anybody got blown up, you know, on our side anyway. Military seem to have, even though they're in the business of death, they have a reticence of acknowledging it.
Lots of reporters made that claim. It's all a matter in the eye of the beholder.
From 1967 to 69, Major General Wynant Seidel was Chief of Information for MACV, the Military Assistance Command, Vietnam. MACV conducted press briefings daily.
We didn't mention all those little battles that went on, and neither did the reporters. I used to chide them sometimes about not giving us some coverage on stories where we'd win a little battle, and they say, well, it wasn't worthwhile. But then, if it's a battle they attended, and we didn't put it out on the air, they would get upset, you know, so it's a matter of judgment.
Jordan St. John was an AFEN newscaster who began his tour in 1969.
For the first 3 or 4 months I was in Vietnam, I never checked a script with anyone. It was only after the anti-war movement was gaining power and gaining influence back in the United States did the military start to clamp down on what was being said. And it was the military lifers fear that somehow that the sentiment of the war was turning against them.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Army Specialist Bob Lawrence with 5 minutes of news compiled from...
Anything that was critical of the Vietnamese government or the Vietnamese military or the American military or the execution of the war in Vietnam was taboo. We received the Cronkite Show 2 days after it aired in the States, and we could use pieces off of that. But before the news guys got it, the captain would review the tape, and he would write down what the story was, whether or not we could use it.
Vietnam, the president warned there remains a long, hard road toward peace, but said he is not pessimistic about the results of his peace efforts.
On January 3, 1970, AFEN newsman Bob Lawrence departed from his approved script.
I pledge to tell the truth at all times, and am always telling the truth, either in the military or as a civilian. In the military in Vietnam, I found that a newscaster at AFEN is not free to tell the truth. And in essence, to tell it like it is.
The broadcast caused a furor in the press and prompted congressional review. Just 3 years earlier, Defense Secretary Robert McNamara had decreed that the flow of information to soldiers should not be restricted. But when McNamara left his post shortly after Tet, the directive had little clout. Bob Lawrence was made a chaplain's assistant and sent to the demilitarized zone.
I'm aware of the Lawrence situation. I'm aware of his allegations. I do not agree with his comments.
Jordan Reiser, chief of U.S. Armed Forces Radio.
If the guy didn't agree with his editor, he claimed there was censorship. But there was not a single incident that I know of. I'm not saying it didn't happen. But I was sitting as chief of broadcasting for the Air Force at the time, and I'm pretty certain that they would have made me aware of it. I know of no such case where that happened. Now, the only case where stories were really barred was if it involved something that could adversely affect American lives in the combat in the field.
Former AFN newscaster Jordan St. John.
The official version of why this was being done, why certain things were kept off the air, was that it would damage morale of the troops out in the field. The real reason it was being done is because the guys in charge of the war could control American forces radio completely. They couldn't control a civilian press. So we were, in fact, although called a news operation, were really a propaganda machine. The whole bit with the inflated body counts and all that. It was all wrapped up in that whole trying to make it look as though we were winning the war when, in fact, we weren't.
And here's a dedication to the new troops who have just recently come into the Republic of Vietnam and every day sit and watch those freedom birds fly back to the world again. Heartbreaker, Led Zeppelin.
Perhaps to fill a need that official armed forces radio could not, GIs took the medium into their own hands. Unsanctioned broadcasts began, with soldiers talking over open channels on field radios. Veteran Barry Romo returned from leave in Hawaii with a battery-powered turntable and 80 records.
We picked up on what's called the BS channel, I think it was 7500, and just started playing records and talked back and forth very slightly about what was going on. I don't know, probably morale type stuff. You're scared, you're hungry, you're going to sleep, you're staying awake. And in a matter of two nights, we probably had contact with 20, 25 outposts. I mean, this was December 67, it was certainly before. A lot of things, including first Tet Offensive, you know, death of Martin Luther King, the assassination of Robert Kennedy, Chicago Convention. It was not the same Vietnam as a year later, December of 68.
A few GIs found ways to reach even larger audiences. Some rigged up FM transmitters and created short-range pirate radio stations. The mysterious Dave Rabbit and his first Termer broadcasts.
Blood Rock 2, Bubble Cross. Good evening again, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host for the next 3 hours of hard acid rock music, Dave Rabbit. And my studio engineer, Pete Sadler. For those of you who have just recently come into the Republic of Vietnam, I'd like to give you a little information about it. We're an underground radio station here, and we say what we feel like saying, and we bring the truth to the first termers in the Republic of Vietnam. We also bring you hard acid rock music all through the night. The up-to-date music of today's American youth. Carlos Santana. Evil Ways.
Pirate radio offered practical tips that couldn't be heard on AFVN.
Blowing a little grass now, going back into music by Steppenwolf called The Pusher. Speaking of The Pusher, brothers and sisters, if you happen to be down by the Magic Finger Lounge anytime tonight, keep away from the Korean at the front door. He's pushing some bad H. I repeat, he's pushing some bad H.
It became a common thing at Commander's Call, which was a monthly or bi-monthly sort of thing, or whenever you happen to be in the orderly room of your particular organization, that they would... Oh, by the way, do you have any information on a clandestine radio station being broadcast? And you go like, gee, no, I haven't heard of it.
In 1970, Bill Davis ended up in the barracks with other Air Force engineers who operated a portable pirate radio station out of Thailand. The serious side of their programming reflected stateside anti-war sentiment and a growing resistance movement within the military.
We would say, like, you know, there's an organization of veterans in the United States who, and active duty military people who call themselves Movement for a Democratic Military, and we feel we have a lot in common with them, and we're opposed to the war that's going on in Vietnam.
The truth would have definitely been nice. I mean,
Jerry Clark served with the 82nd Airborne.
So if I could have heard this on the radio and people saying, hey, when you get home, you know, you're going to run into a mob scene. There's people back there protesting, us being over here. There's people spitting on people at the airport, you know. So be prepared for the worst when you get home because people don't like what you're doing here. Then I think it would have made things easier coming back here to the States for a lot of guys.
5,328,141. 5,328,141.
What are you doing?
Don't bother me. I'm counting the number of seconds I have left in my tour in Vietnam.
Are you anxious to see your tour in the service end?
No, I'm counting the number of hairs on the hippies in San Francisco. 5,328,000.
How'd you like to leave the service 5 months early? You can, you know, simply by extending your tour in Vietnam.
Steve Brown is a Navy veteran who served in Vietnam in 1968. Moonlighting as a stateside FM DJ, he managed shipboard entertainment, secretly using his own records to introduce the latest American rock and roll to the Tonkin Gulf Fleet. He believes that the military establishment never stood a chance to suppress the anti-military and anti-war sentiment inherent in the popular culture of the 60s, veteran Steve Brown.
We know that, and we also know that it was the first war put to a soundtrack of rock and roll, which I think is significant in the fact that part of the generation's cultural significance of the 60s was able to shine through even despite the war.
Armed Forces Radio continues to broadcast servicemen on bases from Berlin to Korea. Censorship of news continues to be an issue, and if it were up to Steve Brown, the resistance would continue and grow.
But I would just say right now that if I had to do it all again, I'd probably do it the same way, except I'd do it a little bit stronger. I'd bring even better equipment and more music, and I think if anybody goes to another war again, be sure to bring your Walkman with you.
Appreciate your recollections and your...
Who else can I hear these tapes?
Well, it's going to be... why don't we start tape, Ted?
Go ahead, let it play, because I want to make an announcement.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
All right.
This is Jerry Irby from Philly. Big Jerry to all the Vietnam vets that knew me. And trying to get in touch with anybody who served with me in Company E, 3rd and the 47th, the 9th Infantry Division, and 67 at Dong Town on the boats. B Troop, 3rd and the 17th Vail Cavalry at Cu Chi and Tainan and Dao Chiang and Zion in 68.
Jonathan Schwartz is executive producer for the Vietnam Radio First Termer series from Interlock Media Associates in Boston. The program is based largely on original research by co-producer Alexis Milner. NPR executive producer is Frank Tavares. George Holmesy and NPR's Kari Huss are the associate producers. First Termer was mixed by Frank Cunningham at WGBH in Boston. It was edited and engineered by Joshua Weinman, Robert Connolly, Monty McGuire, Charles Racina, Rick Wolf, David Lavallee, and Jim Moses. Theme music by Paul Roost, voiceover and translation by Diego Arcenegas. Project staff includes Kate Atkinson, Barbara Bernstein, Robert Dickinson, Ann Harrison, Kristen Amberling, Ricardo Ray, Chris Bailey, and Laura Crosby. Writing and editorial assistance from William Lichtenstein, Robert Dietrich, Beth Harrington, Tom Watkins, Judy Roddenbeck, and Robin Washington. Also special thanks to the following stations for the use of their facilities, KCRW in Santa Monica, California, WUSF, Tampa, Florida, KWIT, Cedar Falls, Iowa, and WRMS and WJNO in West Palm Beach, Florida. Also, we gratefully acknowledge the many individuals and organizations who opened their archives to first-termer researchers and veterans organizations nationwide who provided invaluable assistance. The series was produced in cooperation with Boston's Public Media Foundation. Funding has been provided by the Fund for Tomorrow and Club Computer, the Massachusetts Foundation for the Humanities and Public Policy, the Massachusetts Council on the Arts and the Humanities, the William Joyner Center for the Study of War and Social Consequences at the University of Massachusetts in Boston, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and NPR member stations. I'm Scott Simon. This is NPR National Public Radio.